Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the world's loudest talk show host, Bruce Snow Ghost Russell!
Thank you. How's it going, Bruce?
Pretty good.
Bruce, have you been in this building behind us?
No.
I think Cindy's been in there. Cindy, what's this building called?
It's the American Antiquarian Society.
Is it worth checking out?
Yes.
I say let's do it.
My name is James David Moran. I'm the Director of Outreach here at the American Antiquarian Society, and it's my great pleasure to give you a video tour of this building, Antiquarian Hall, the home of the Society, located in Worcester, Massachusetts. The American Antiquarian Society is a learned society and a national research library of pre-20th century American history and culture. Our mission is to collect one copy of everything printed between the years 1640, when the English first established a printing press, through the year 1876, the year of our nation's centennial. Within that time period, we try to collect everything. The strength of the collection is in our pre-1821 materials, in which we believe we have two-thirds of everything printed in this country. The collections include all kinds of material from all 50 states, the British West Indies, and Canada. They include books, pamphlets, newspapers, graphic arts materials, sheet music, and manuscripts. They also include a wide variety and diversity of modern secondary works and bibliographical works. When we were founded in 1812, our mission was to include all kinds of artifacts and anthropological and archaeological materials, as well as printed materials. Over time, we've narrowed our focus to being just a research library. As a learned society, the society is composed of about 900 members who are nominated and elected to membership, as well as an alliance for the Antiquarian Society, which is open to all people. Up until 1960, our membership was exclusively male. But with the election of Worcester native Esther Forbes, the author of Johnny Tremaine and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Paul Revere and the World He Lived In, we diversified our membership to include women. Now, 25% of our elected members are women. Ellen Dunlap is now the president or executive director, the first woman to lead the organization in its history. Notable AAS members include Thomas Jefferson, Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, DeWitt Clinton, Alexander Graham Bell, Ken Burns, David McCullough, and Barbara Bush. 13 U.S. presidents have been elected to membership. AAS members have won a total of 70 Pulitzer Prizes and 42 Bancroft Prizes. As a learned society, we offer a wide variety of programs for a wide diversity of people, from professional historians and scholars to academics, educators in grades K through 12, to senior adults, to the general public. We offer our services free through the generosity of our donors, including Stephen Salisbury III, who donated the land to build this building in 1909. We offer a wide variety of programs, from fellowships that allow researchers to come to the society. We offer about 35 different fellowships a year through programs for academic scholars and historians, including sponsoring conferences, seminars, and workshops, through programs directed specifically for K-12 educators and their students. We present a series of free public lectures and performances open to the public. We also sponsor a series of specialized programs, including the program in the history of the book in America, which is a multidisciplinary scholarly look at the impact of all kinds of publishing and writing on society. We have just started a Center for Historic American Visual Culture, which will promote the use of images in the teaching of history and literature. And we are in the midst of publishing a 5-volume history of the book, which covers the history of, and influence of printing and publishing throughout the history of the United States. These are just some of the programs that we offer to people both here in Worcester and throughout the country. This man, Isaiah Thomas, founded the American Antiquarian Society in 1812. He was born in Boston in 1749, and although his grandfather was a wealthy merchant, his father abandoned the family when Thomas was just an infant and impoverished them. Thomas was put into an apprenticeship with a printer by the name of Zachariah Fowle by the overseers of the poor, an early form of child welfare. Thomas literally learned to read and write by setting type. In fact, the society has a copy of the first thing Thomas ever set in type, a licentious ballad called The Lawyer's Pedigree. Thomas, through his intelligence and great skill, eventually took over his master's business, and he became an important patriotic printer in the time leading up to the American Revolution. During the Revolution, he was a rabble-rouser fighting for independence. After the war, he became an important printer and publisher in the early Republic. He retired from business in 1802 and began writing a 2-volume history of printing, which he published in 1809. To do research for that work, he asked all his fellow printers to send him copies of things they printed. And he didn't want just their important works, he wanted everything they printed, from their newspapers, to their broadside ballads, to their ads for runaway slaves. He felt that anything that was printed was important. He gathered it into his collection, he used it in his research for the history of printing in America, and he donated it to the society when he founded it in 1812. This became the nucleus for our collection. And his philosophy of printing, that all things are important, is something we carry on to this day. Thomas's personal life was very interesting as well. His first wife, Mary Dill, was a beauty from Bermuda who ran away with an American-born British officer on the eve of the American Revolution. He took possession of their 2 children and raised them to adulthood. His second wife, a distant cousin by the name of Mary Thomas, was the love of his life. They were married happily for 34 years until her death. His third wife was a distant cousin of Mary, Rebecca Armstrong. This was not a happy union. She loved to party, he loved to read. Eventually, they lived apart. Thomas died at the age of 82 in 1831. He's buried in Worcester at Rural Cemetery. Now let's head up the stairs and see Isaiah Thomas's printing press, Old Number 1. This is Old Number 1. This is the printing press that Isaiah Thomas learned how to print on when he was apprenticed to Zachariah Fowle in Boston. This press was built in London in 1747 and then transported to this country. This press gained great importance to this country and to Isaiah Thomas when he took possession of it after taking over his master's business. He used this press to create a sedition foundry and rally Americans to the cause of independence in Boston in the 1770s. In fact, it became such a rallying cry for independence that his friends, John Hancock, Sam Adams, and Timothy Bigelow, were concerned the press would be impounded by the British authorities. They convinced Thomas to get it out of Boston and bring it to Worcester. In his own words, he stole it out of Boston on the night of April 16th, 1775. 3 days later, the battles of Lexington and Concord took place. Thomas was present at those battles. He came back to Worcester and waited for paper to be delivered. When it finally arrives on May 3rd, 1775, he publishes this edition of his newspaper, The Massachusetts Spy. The Spy is one of the most popular newspapers in the colonies at this time. And this, as Thomas tells us in his own hand, is the first thing ever printed and published in Worcester. His political sentiments are clear by the title above the masthead, Americans, Liberty or Death, Join or Die. And inside this newspaper is his account, the first-hand account of the battles of Lexington and Concord. Thomas recognized the importance of Old Number One. He kept it with him throughout his business career, even when he had 19 similar presses like this running in Worcester alone. At one point, he set Old Number One aside, and he preserved it, and he bequeathed it to the society. The technology of printing in Isaiah Thomas's time changed very little from the time of Gutenberg, and it starts with setting type. These type cases that contain individual fonts are set up much like a typewriter, a keyboard is, and that is that the sorts or fonts or pieces of type that you use the most are set up in close range so you can grab them easily. Each piece of type has a small notch on one side, and you lay that in a composing stick with all the notches up, ensuring that it will print correctly on the page. You can actually set type without reading or seeing the type at all, doing it all by hand and by touch. Once you've filled up the composing stick, you come back to this composing stone and lay it all into a metal frame called a chase. When a chase is fully loaded with type, it could weigh as much as 100 pounds. Then you set the chase on the press with the type facing up. You put paper into the tympan here. You then beat the press with ink using a printer's ball by gently applying the ink like so. This tympan then folds over the type. The printer with his left hand would crank this crank called the rouse to move the bed under the press itself. Then he pulls on this bar with his right hand. This is a very difficult operation to do. In fact, this bar is called the devil's tail because it was so difficult to pull. And it would overdevelop a printer's right side. Printers could even tell their profession by looking at a printer walk down the street, because they developed a special walk called the printer's gait. Once the pressure is applied to the chase, the process would be reversed, and that this crank would be pulled out so that the bed is brought out, the tippin is tipped up, the paper is taken out and hung to dry, because it's actually the paper is wet when it's being printed. If you're going to print the other side, you wait for it to dry, then you re-wet it and do the process all over again. With two printers working on a press, one beating, one pulling, and assorted apprentices feeding and taking paper off it, they could do 240 sheets an hour, which would be about half of a royal ream of paper. This press itself was restored in the 1970s at Old Sturbridge Village. This black pieces on the press, this crusted black pieces, we're not quite sure what this is. We know it's carbon-based, and we suspect that it was just excess ink that was applied to the press to keep the printing job clean. Here we are in the council room, so-called because our board of directors, or council, meets in this room. It's also a place where we hold workshops and seminars, and people can interact directly with library materials. The room is filled with wonderful artifacts, including the Emma DeForest Morse collection of Staffordshire pottery, which came to us in 1913. This collection of about 325 pieces was all made in England for the American trade. That is, it was designed to be sold and consumed by Americans. It is composed of American scenes, landscapes, personalities, and historical events. And most of them are based upon lithographs that are also in our collection. We also have artifacts from when the Society was the Smithsonian before there was a Smithsonian. That is, when we collected both artifacts and library materials. When we changed our mission to being just a library in the early 20th century, we deacquisitioned most of our artifacts, but kept those we couldn't bear to part with in this room, including a vial of tea from the Boston Tea Party, a powder horn from the French and Indian War, and an eagle that once was in the White House. Also in this room is the Sheffield Plate Triple Urn, which was presented to Isaiah Thomas by the London Guild of Printers in honor of his work on the two-volume History of Printing in America that he wrote. Also in this room are some furniture, a large clock, a settee, and this desk that once belonged to John Hancock and was in his office in Boston. This desk also has some secrets. Inside are some wonderful secret compartments. Also in this room is a high chair made in this country for either Increase or Cotton Mather. This room also contains wonderful portraits. There is a portrait of Clarence Brigham, who was librarian and president of the Society from 1908 to 1962. He greatly expanded the collections, was a bibliographer of American newspapers, and was instrumental in creating this building itself. Another portrait in this room is of Marcus McCorrison, who was president immediately following Clarence Brigham. He was librarian and then president. Marcus McCorrison created the fellowship program, created some national touring of our collections, and really put the Society on a national stage in the mid and late 20th century. This is the reading room of Antiquarian Hall, where people from all over the world come to do their work. Like most research libraries, our stacks are closed. That is, our bookshelves are closed to the public. Readers fill out call slips, give them to our staff, who go into the stacks to retrieve the material for them. Now I'm going to show you something that researchers working in the library for 25 years might not have seen. I'm going to show you our book stacks. The AAS collection contains about 3 million items, housed on 25 miles of shelving. We're standing in the oldest part of the building, built in 1909, but the building was added onto in 1924, 1950, 1972, and last in 2002. This part of the building is state-of-the-art library construction for the early 20th century, and it includes glass floors and clear glass windows to allow more light into the building. Since that time, we've frosted over the glass windows because we now know that ultraviolet lighting is bad for historic materials. The steel shelving, which rises 5 floors, actually supports the roof of the building, and some of the shelving is specially designed to house library materials, like our newspapers. We have a major collection of American newspapers, some 2 million issues, that take up about 5 miles of shelving. Here are some of our more popular collections. We've got local history collections on my left, and genealogy and family histories on my right. But remember, these local histories are not just for New England. They contain local histories throughout the United States. When this building was first built, it had no fire detection or suppression system. People then were just as concerned about things getting wet as they were being consumed by fire. Since then, we've added a state-of-the-art detection system that's water-based. Should an emergency discharge the water, we have a method of freeze-drying the material so our conservators can have time to figure out the best way to preserve that material. The graphic arts collection contains many things, including maps and atlases, which are particularly strong for New England, prints, broadsides, sheet music, and ephemera, including book plates, greeting cards, bill heads, trade cards, bills of lading, telegraph forms, menus, and many other items. Some collections are cataloged and accessible through the online catalog. This is the new book stack edition. It's 2 floors and 10-foot high compact shelving, and it was constructed in 2002. It's state-of-the-art library construction for the 21st century. The compact shelving allows for less space between shelving and more storage capacity. We believe we've increased our storage capacity by 90% with this addition alone. The most valuable and earliest materials are housed in this part of the library. That includes all our pre-1821 imprints, about 60,000 items. It's kept at 60 degrees temperature and 40% humidity. It's not particularly comfortable for humans, but it wasn't built for humans. There are no outside windows. This is a book vault designed to house our most precious items. Remember, even though the Society digitizes a lot of our materials, we never get rid of anything. The AAS library also contains about 1,400 manuscript collections. A manuscript collection can be anything from a diary in one volume to a large collection with 65 boxes and over 100 volumes, such as the Salisbury family papers. The manuscript collections in the AAS archives total more than 2,000 linear feet of shelf space. We add 40 to 50 new collections per year through both gift and purchase. The focus is largely on New England, and the strengths are early New England materials, such as the Mather family papers, which came to AAS with the Mather Library in 1814, New England diaries, Central Massachusetts family papers, diaries, church records, and business records, and material relating to the book trades. The book trades materials are national in scope. As part of the Society's mission to make our collections available for study, we've worked with third-party vendors to digitize portions of our collections. These are available through various websites to scholars and researchers throughout the world.
Wait, so what is this?
This is a book. It's a scrapbook put together by the same man, Nathaniel Payne. He was a great scrapbookist. And it's entitled Freaks of Nature. And literally, these are sideshow personalities that apparently he came across and made an entire scrapbook out of.
That looks like the
people. Professor Riley.
A tattooed man.
It looks like the tattooed man.
Yeah. Doctorate in tattoos, pretty good.
Mr. DeCourcy. Tattooed by Mr. Hildebrand of New York and Stephen Lee of Philadelphia.
Hmm. Here's Nathaniel Payne himself.
There's John Murphy, the Irish giant. Oh, and it's Pat O'Brien.
Jojo the dog face man.
Jojo the dog face man. Barnum and Bailey and Hutchinson. That is Riot. A nondescript child.
That's that child's freakery. Here's a child who you'll not remember 1 second after leaving the venue. The nondescript boy.
Up, oh, Chang'an.
There you go.
The Siamese twins.
Pretty good. Little articles about them.
Articles about them. Up, oh, and the elephant boy.
Hmm.
Yes, Mr. Payne's interests were wide and many and varied. Two remarkable Indian dwarves.
Wow.
Very interesting.